The election lawsuits are dying a merciful death, and Mackenzie Smith is here to gloat. The Supreme Court takes up the latest installment of the Obamacare cases in California v. Texas. I want to know, how can Congress keep getting away with calling something that tripled the price of health insurance the Affordable Care Act? Well, we unpack all of these issues while brining our turkeys in this week's debriefing of the law. Welcome to this week's debriefing of the law. I am Joel Ost, your host, and Mackenzie, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be back. It's been a minute.
It's been a lot has happened since we have last talked. I think the world is coming to a crashing halt. So much to talk about, but let's just start off with COVID. You are there in Pennsylvania. You're getting ready to get shut down. Is that right?
We have had some additional restrictions lately because everything is kind of really peaking, it seems like, here. I'm currently recording from my closet, which I haven't done since probably April or May. So it's been a while, but here I am again. Although this time, you know, I've got a glass of wine with me. It's cold outside. It's a different vibe than it was back in the spring, for sure. I feel like this is old hat at this point. But yeah, the local authorities, and then I think even the governor, imposed some new restrictions, one of which is that they are banning on-premises alcohol sales tomorrow night for Thanksgiving Eve, which really has caused a commotion in the Commonwealth.
Really?
So, yes.
I'm not sure I understand that. They're banning on-site alcohol consumption?
Yeah, like bars and restaurants cannot sell alcohol, I think, tomorrow evening. I don't know what the time cutoff is, but I think the idea is, you know, the night before Thanksgiving is a big going out night for people who still do that. So they want to discourage that. So they are not letting people sell alcohol. Yeah.
See, when you've been a parent, as long as I've been a parent, you're kind of out of the whole party scene. I had no idea that the Wednesday before Thanksgiving was some kind of party night. I guess we've always been traveling to family's house as long as I can remember. I am just preparing for turkey. I can tell you, Thanksgiving is by far and away my favorite holiday. It's not even close. I mean, it's got it all going for you. It's got football. You can't beat football. So many different games. Three NFL games. My Nebraska Cornhuskers will be playing on Friday. That's still part of the whole holiday. And so you got football. You got food. Oh, I am so big on the food. Are you one of the preparers of Thanksgiving food?
Yes, I usually make, so typically we do Thanksgiving at my parents' house. My mom does the turkey, but I'll make, you know, several sides, usually a pie. So it's kind of a group effort, but I do typically participate in the Thanksgiving making, but I'm not a huge,
now you say participate.
You know, I'm not a huge,
what does that
turkey
mean?
Fan. I gotta say,
like, whoa. You're not a huge turkey fan?
No, I don't like, I actually don't like very much of it at all. I don't like mashed potatoes. I don't like, I'll eat it. Like, I'm not a picky eater. I'll eat pretty much anything. Like, I'm not going to complain about it, but if given the choice, I would eat something else.
No.
So I think we're just we're quarantining. My toddler is in quarantine right now because
I am not buying this at all.
No, it's
you
true.
Have not had it done the right way. I'm telling you, I am now, that's going to be one of my missions. You somehow have got to be introduced to quality. Have you ever had a smoked turkey?
I've had smoked, I've had deep fried, I've had turducken. Roasted turkey.
Wow.
I like it. Like, it's not bad. I'll eat it, but it's not, certainly not one of my favorite meals.
Oh my goodness. We did a progressive dinner way back when, where, you know, we have four different couples and we all go to one person's house. We all would bring a dish. Right. And so we all decided, let's do this Thanksgiving style. So we had fried turkey. You know, it's probably the best turkey I've ever had in my life. Someone brought the sweet potatoes. It was so incredible. They found a way to have the crunchy tops to it with the marshmallows. Oh, and then the stuffing, again, a crunchy top to the stuffing. It was just to die for, Ellen. So I am so excited about Thanksgiving this week. And I have already started the process. I got two birds. I named my birds. We got Tyrone and Tyreen. And they are both in the brining because you got to brine them for at least 2 days before you smoke them. And so that way you can get the juiciness all throughout the meat. And so I'm just excited. Now, I do have a problem, though, with meat. I got to tell you, I don't understand it. I have two birds in the refrigerator right now. They're in their brining juices. And I just smoked a rack of ribs today and then also 2 dozen wings. And then I have 2 chickens also that I smoked 2 days ago. I haven't even touched that. Both of those are sitting in the fridge, have yet to be cut into. So I have this problem of just cooking meat. I got to cook and cook and cook. So, hey, I'm all caught up in the Thanksgiving spirit. So because of that, now's a great time to talk election. I'm feeling giving. And you apparently are in the victory lane. You want to gloat a little bit. Let's talk about these election losses. Now, let's just start off here on the same page. I want to make sure you and I are on the same page with these election losses, okay? Can we at least agree to this, McKenzie? Can we agree that Trump will be our next president of the United States? Will you admit defeat now that you surely just saw the press conference with the infamous hair dye press conference with Rudy Giuliani? It's over for you guys. Admit it.
I guess we're just living in 2 different worlds. You're living in some meat-fueled delusion out there in the Midwest, and I'm living in reality, I won't concede anything.
Wow, that press conference. You know what I'm talking about, right? The one where he is there with his 2 other attorneys. Jenna Ellis was one. And was it Cindy Powell?
Sydney,
was that the name of the...
I think her name's Sydney... Now the last name escaped. Sydney Powell. I think that's her name. Yeah.
All right. So, you're talking about the Three Stooges, and I like Jenna Ellis. I mean, but my goodness, what was that about?
That was obnoxious. That was actually kind of scary to me. First of all, we can get into this more, but part of me feels, it actually got to a point where I started feeling pity for Rudy Giuliani. I feel like, I was an adult when September 11th happened, and I'm not a New Yorker, but I really feel like he was a great figure at that moment in time, and I think he was a very popular, well-liked mayor for the most part, and did a lot of great things for New York City. And even before that, my understanding is that he was a very well-respected prosecutor in New York City, and it really
cleaned up New York City.
Yeah, it really seems like he has just fallen so far, and it was almost like a caricature. It was like a caricature, and it was one of those moments where you're just like, I don't even know. I mean, I can't. It's frightening because of what they're saying, but it's also so bombastic and ridiculous to almost make you feel pity.
Oh, I know. It does. It reminded me of Saturday Night Live. Like, is this a skit? Are these the real characters that are out there? Now, you were both lawyers, and so we know that there are, when you sign your name to a pleading, there's going to be a Rule 11. Lawyers know that as a sanctions rule, where you got to have a good basis in law or fact to present these claims. And so we know when you show up in court, that's one thing. But when you're at a press conference, you're not bound by Rule 11. You're not bound by the rules of evidence. They can say whatever they want. And apparently they decided, let's just say whatever we want. Didn't they even allege communists have infiltrated our election cycle and all kinds of, it was crazy.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, someone mentioned Hugo Chavez, who died a decade ago, had something to do with this, and it was really it was crazy from my point of view. But apparently there are people. There are people out there who really buy into this, and unfortunately, some of them are on these local canvassing boards that have to certify local elections. And it's really putting people like that in a difficult situation because they don't know what to do. And in fact, I think there was one individual in, I believe it was Michigan, who ended up abstaining from rendering a vote in the certification process. And that's a pretty big deal. I mean, it's, you know, they're statutorily obligated to certify election results, and refusing to do it is kind of a big deal because that's literally your job. So it does, I think on the whole, it appears that as of today, I guess, or yesterday, the transition has officially begun. And I guess while President Trump has said he's still not conceding or admitting defeat, you know, the process is in the works. So I think the overall takeaway from all of this drama is that, you know, the system actually does work, and it has worked.
It does work. And it always will.
Right. There are backstops and there are redundancies and there are checks and balances. However, I think, you know, on a less optimistic note, we can see that there are some cracks there that, you know, rhetoric and words and, you know, saying things in a press conference or in a tweet, like, they do eventually erode public trust and they do have an effect on people. And we see that with the abstention votes and, you know, a lot of other things that have been going on. So while I think we can look at this and say, look, there is a Republican Secretary of State in Georgia who stood up to Lindsey Graham. There's Republican members of these canvassing boards that, you know, did their jobs faithfully and correctly. And we should all, like, be, you know, grateful for that. And, you know, like, recognizing and acknowledging that these people are doing their jobs and putting the law over, you know, an individual, what an individual wants. But, you know, there are some cracks. So it's been wild. I mean, it's been really crazy.
Well, here's what I know about lawsuits, about election lawsuits. I've been involved in several of them. The first thing that I know is that votes matter. So if you're going to say, oh, he's going to challenge it in court, if my side loses, we're going to challenge it in court, what does that really mean? Well, first of all, courts don't overturn votes. That is just so rare. It maybe has happened a couple times out there, but I'm just telling you that is extremely, extremely rare. Courts are very wary of overturning votes. They just don't do that. That would upset our democracy in a very significant way. So they don't do that. So what do? They set rules on how votes are counted. So if you want to do a recount, okay, let's recount now, and these are going to be the rules on how we do the recount. But votes absolutely matter. And here, Biden has the votes. It's just, no matter how you count these up, Biden has them. And so I didn't see where these lawsuits were going. I mean, here's my take. So number one, votes matter. And then number two, you can ask for recounts. But again, you're still going to be counting the votes. And there's no indication that the recounts here are going to come up with a different result. So I always thought that Trump really was angling to somehow appease his base, maybe prove that fraud did happen, albeit on a very small level, but, you know, fraud did happen at a certain level. And maybe that's going to help out his 2024 campaign. That's my best take. This is all about 2024. Any thoughts on that?
Either that or, you know, he's going to start a cable news channel or something like that. I mean, I think there's a not insignificant part of this that comes from just, like, pure narcissism, like, inability accept that you lost fair and... I mean, it honestly reminds me of, like, when I play a board game or chess or something with my 10-year-old, and even he doesn't really do this anymore, but, like, if I start winning, he'll get upset and say, oh, well, you moved when I went to the bathroom, you moved your piece, or, you know, he'll accuse me like doing things, or, oh, here's one for you. We have a family fantasy football league. And I'm terrible, but for whatever reason, I was projected to beat there's a team with my son and my stepson on it. So my son, when I wasn't looking, went into my phone and changed my lineup so that I wouldn't win. And I I didn't realize until after the weekend was over, because I don't check it that often. And I had like 40 points less than the projection. So I started looking at the players like, well, wait a minute. I didn't, you know, put that quarterback in or whatever. So it really reminds me of like a middle school or even younger tactic of like, oh, I can't possibly be losing. This is, you know, earth shattering to my identity and my sense of self. Like, I have to start pointing fingers. You know, it's too painful for me to look in the mirror and say, like, you lost. So I have to start pointing fingers. So I think there's a lot of it that's that. But yeah, also to just give a narrative to the future audience, whether it be, you know, a cable news audience or, you know, customers of some product or future base of voters, I definitely think like the storyline has something to it. And you're absolutely right. Like, you can tell at a press conference, I mean, I guess so long as you're not defaming anybody, you can tell whatever story you want, even if it has, it's completely untethered to fact. But, you know, while there are, you know, unfortunately, very few places in America where objective truth still matters, I truly believe that courtrooms are one of them. And yeah, you can't even, you know, you hear people saying like, well, he has the right to pursue every legal challenge and he has the right to bring these lawsuits. And it's like, well, what does that even mean? Like, you have the right to do what? Because you actually don't have the right to make false allegations in court, and you don't have the right to pursue frivolous legal arguments. And that's what you just said. Like, so there are rules for that. Like, you actually don't have the right to do that. So
right. You just can't file a lawsuit against someone because you don't like them. You gotta have to have a basis in law or fact. So talk a little bit about that, because you're there in Pennsylvania, and that's where a lot of this is happening. So you've had a little bit closer, you know, view of what's going on. And you attended a recent court hearing where Giuliani was talking. I think you attended via phone, but go ahead and just talk a little bit about that experience.
Right. So the federal case in Pennsylvania, which was filed by the Trump campaign in the Middle District of Pennsylvania, which is one of our three federal jurisdictions, I happened to have some experience with the judge that was assigned to the case, and my county, Chester County, is one of the defendants in the case. So and I'm also a Democratic committee member in my county. So I had some personal interest, also being a political junkie, had some personal interest in the lawsuit. So I followed it very closely. And yeah, I mean, essentially it was a 250 something paragraph complaint that was full of, well, all kinds of language, but the bottom line is there was an allegation of equal protection violations under the 14th Amendment that basically said, you know, the Secretary of State of Pennsylvania came out several weeks before the election and issued guidance to all the counties that said, you know, there's going to be a ton of mail-in ballots. We saw this at the primaries. A lot of people don't realize they have to sign the affidavit on the outside of the envelope. And a lot of people have the signature, you know, doesn't match what's in the book. So here are the standards to apply. And if you look at the envelopes, if you receive them prior to Election Day, and they're non-conforming, and so the ballot will be disqualified, you are allowed to contact those voters of either party or both parties and tell them, you know, we received your ballot, it's non-conforming. If you would like to go to your polling place on Election Day and fill out a provisional ballot, you're allowed to do that. And I think the provisional ballots, like, they're only for statewide and nationwide candidates. So it's not a full ballot, but you can still go fill it out, and they don't get counted until the very end if they would be dispositive.
Are you saying in some counties up there in Pennsylvania, if you did a mail-in ballot, the whoever receives it can say, look, you didn't do it the right way? So they actually would track these people down and say, hey, look, you mailed in a ballot and it's wrong. Do you want to fix it? Is that what was going on?
Pretty much. I mean, I did a mail-in ballot, and what happens is, you know, you request it, you apply for it, it gets sent to you, you mail it back in, and when they receive it, you get an email that says, we received your ballot, and they're not allowed to open it until Election Day. You know, my understanding is, you know, that email, if the ballot had been non-conforming, would have said, received non-conforming, and it would say, like, you're allowed to go to your polling place and fill out a provisional ballot if you want to. Even I could have filled out a provisional ballot, even though my ballot was conforming, they wouldn't have counted. Like, they only count one of them, obviously.
So is this an automatic Was this an automatic email that went back to them, or was this some kind of subjective determination of someone on the other end saying, hey, look, I got this ballot in. It's non-conforming. I'm going to call this person back, but I don't have time to call them all back. But I'm going to make sure I call at least this handful. How did that? How was that decision made to even call that person and say, hey, your ballot is non-conforming?
So that, I think, depends on the county. There were some counties that didn't do it at all. And I don't know, again, like I didn't receive such an email, so I don't know how the counties did it. I would imagine that they would have to do it uniformly. Like there's a standard. I mean, even when you go to vote, at least in Pennsylvania, right, when you go to your polling place, you have to sign the book and you're the person, the poll watcher or the poll worker, looks at your signature that you sign and they look at the signature that's recorded in the book as your signature. And if they don't match, they don't let you vote. So it's the same standard that they apply to the mail-in ballot. They just don't, okay, you're not there in person, but it's the same, you know, standard of review, if you will.
Right, right. See, I have two initial thoughts to this. One, I am bothered a little bit by how subjective it is, because I can see some poll workers trying a lot harder to get a hold of some people. Hey, you know what? You got to really fix your ballot because it's problematic. By the way, I happen to know that this is a Democratic. You voted Democratic in the last election, or you tried to vote for, you know, Biden. I could see some people not trying as hard if they thought it was a Republican ballot as compared to a Democratic ballot, or vice versa. Some subjective element going into that effort to contact these people. But the other thought I had is, this can be a lot of ballots. I mean, we're probably just talking about, I don't know, but not enough to change the outcome of the election, which is one of the big deals. Yes, you might be able to prove some of the procedures were problematic, but is it going to be at the scale needed to overturn the vote? Usually the answer to that question is no. It's not going to be on that kind of scale.
Well, right. And even, I mean, even if you do apply this procedure, like it does, I understand what you're saying. However, nobody is being allowed to vote twice. Right. Nobody is fraudulently voting. I mean, the procedure doesn't in any way prevent people who are eligible to vote. It's not suppressing voters. In fact, it's the opposite.
But if a poll worker is only going after certain segments and say, hey, I want you to fix your ballot, that's a problem. I mean,
there was no allegation of that.
Okay.
There was no allegation of that. So we don't know. I mean, I don't, and again, I don't have firsthand knowledge of how the counties applied this standard, other than I know that the standard of review for the signature on a mail-in ballot is the same as the signature you would put on the poll. But I mean, you know, I worked at the polls on election day and, you know, I work for the Democratic Party. I'm not an employee of the county. I'm a volunteer, but you know, we have a voter roll of all the voters in our precinct. And when it starts getting late in the day, I mean, and you can see who has voted and who hasn't. Like you get on the phone and start calling people and saying like, hey, you didn't vote. Come on. You only have 3 hours left. Like this, you know, and if we do a better job of that than the Republicans, well, that's certainly not my problem. That's your guys' problem.
I see how it works now. I see how it works. Yes. Well, didn't you also say that not every county was allowing for these to be changed? In fact, some Republican counties were taking the position of, no, we're not going to allow for this to happen. But in maybe the more Democratic-leaning areas, they were allowing for this to happen?
Yes. So that was the allegation. So the allegation was not that, you know, within a county, they were only contacting Democrats and not Republicans. That was not alleged in the lawsuit, and there's no evidence that that happened. What the allegation was that some counties were contacting voters and telling them, you know, you can fix your ballot or you can go fill out a provisional, and some counties were not. And the counties that did not do it tended to be, at least the allegation goes, more rural, more Republican counties. And, you know, there's a reasonable explanation for that, that being, you know, less populated counties have less infrastructure. I mean, they don't have as many people working. They don't have as many resources. They don't have the infrastructure to, like, you know, do something like that. So it makes sense. But, you know, in any event, that was the allegation.
I think the Supreme Court would have a problem with that. I really do. I based upon how things played out in Bush v. Gore, allowing that subjective element into the voting process, I think is problematic. The problem is going to be twofold. One, this was not done on a wide enough scale to actually change the outcome of the election. That's what I'm saying. Votes absolutely matter. You've got to have a count that's in favor of your candidate, because if you don't, the courts aren't going to give you any love here. And so here, even if they, we're only talking about just a, so there is no vote here for Biden or for Trump. The second thought is you're not dealing with that many votes. Even if there was some fraud and the court was inclined to give some kind of remedy, I think you and I can agree that we'd have no idea what that remedy would look like. I mean, at best, I think what the court could say is that these are the standards and procedures. Go count again, maybe. But I just don't see the court throwing out any votes. So I don't even know what the remedy would be. Do you have any idea, Mackenzie, the number of ballots we're even talking about here?
I have no idea, because the case didn't even get that far, because exactly like you're saying, well, there were standing issues, there were justiciability issues, and I think, you know, part of it also is, yeah, unless you're going to touch something from this election, you can't, courts are not allowed to render advisory opinions, so a court can't, just can't say, like, you know, in the future you should do this. That's not, they're there to adjudicate a present, current controversy. So there were a lot of issues with the case. It was very problematic before you even get to the merits. But no, I mean, there was no evidence. There was no evidentiary hearing. So we don't know exactly how many ballots. But yeah, they would definitely would not have been enough to be dispositive, especially since the plaintiffs who, the individual plaintiffs in the case who are complaining that their counties didn't contact them and therefore they were deprived of their right to vote. They didn't even sue their own counties. They sued other counties.
So. Yeah, and that's very hard to do. If you say, hey, look, I was denied the right to free speech. Let's pick free speech. That means you can't speak over there. Well, no, that means you should be allowed to speak. You don't silence other people. Now, I get what you're saying. This is a vote, and the only way to make it fair is to then throw out everyone's vote. I get where that argument comes from, the spirit of it. I'm just going to say that's a non-starter with courts. The courts are not going to throw out votes. It's just something they are very, very reluctant to do. I mean, you're going to need fraud on the level that I don't think we've ever seen in our generations. Maybe the history books might show some fraud way back when. I'm thinking of LBJ when he was a senator running. There's all kinds of amazing stories that happened back then. But unless you have some kind of really amazing fraud allegation and some proof of it, you're not going to throw out election. But interesting. Well, now, let's also now talk about the posture of the case. And so you're saying, and I think most of these cases actually were decided at a motion to dismiss, which means the lawsuit was filed, and you're not even going to get to the facts. You're not even going to get to the proof. What the court is going to say is, look, you don't even have a claim. I mean, we're going to throw this out. We're going to assume everything you say is true. Even so, go home. You don't have a claim. And that's a motion to dismiss. That's the posture before the court. Well, Jenna Ellis, one of the lawyers for Trump, she said that it was a blessing in disguise, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, that the court ruled when it did, as fast as it did. Now they can appeal it and get another court to rule on this matter. Does that make any sense to you?
That makes no sense to me whatsoever. I think, you know, when you say something like, well, the court didn't even get to the proof or didn't even hear any evidence, it sounds bad because, you know, you listen to these press conferences and they're saying, oh, we have affidavits, we have so much proof. And, you know, a layperson might think, well, shouldn't the court hear that? But like you just said, no, because on a motion to dismiss, the court actually assumes that you do have all of the proof. Like, you don't need an evidentiary hearing because the court has to believe everything that you're saying is true and backed up by admissible evidence. So what the court in this case said is, you know, even if everything you're saying is true, you still don't have a claim. Like, I'm not going to invalidate 6.8 million votes.
Right.
Because
it's not gonna happen.
A couple people didn't get called to go fill out a provisional ballot, which, by the way, the provisional ballots didn't get counted anyway.
Right. And so what's going to happen, let's say that Jenna is right and an appellate court or maybe even the Supreme Court agrees with her argument and says, yeah, you're right. Now the clock is going to run out because we have an outside deadline of, I think, the week before the Electoral College meets. So I'm just making up these dates, but I think generally the Electoral College meets around December 16th, somewhere in that area. And so you're looking at the first week of December, this has to be decided, which means the Supreme Court has to rule on this. It has to then get sent back to Pennsylvania, and then they have to have a trial. To find out, okay, you know what, you did state a claim, now let's prove it. Well, that the clock has now run out. So if your objective is to put Trump in the White House in 2020, this is not a good sign. If your objective, however, is to get him in the White House in 2024, maybe this is okay. Because maybe if you get a Supreme Court decision saying, yes, you stated a claim, but now the clock has run out. And so they're left, they're going to go to their constituency and say, look, we were robbed. There was fraud. We just ran out of time. But now let's start our campaign for 2024.
Yeah, I mean, and I just think I agree with you on the timeline. I think there's only a couple weeks left, maybe 2 weeks left. You know, they could have an expedited evidentiary hearing, but at that point, you would actually need evidence. So you'd have to come forward with enough evidence. And I just would be very shocked if that existed in this case, because I know that they've been submitting affidavits in other cases that are literally just hearsay statements. So that's not admissible. So, but I mean, who knows?
Right.
The clock would run out, but I just find, like, you know, just hypothesizing, I just feel like the Supreme Court would be very hard pressed, or even, you know, the Third Circuit would be very hard pressed to find an equal protection violation here, or, you know, to find that this complaint stated a claim under equal protection, because in order to do that, you'd essentially have to be saying that every time two counties within a state administer an election differently, there might be a viable equal protection argument. And that means that in literally every election going forward, there is just, I mean, the floodgates of litigation over elections would open. And I think Judge Brand, in his opinion from the district court, made a really good point on this fact, because, you know, initially when I read the complaint, I said, oh, okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that the counties were doing it differently. And, you know, it does certainly raise an eyebrow. I mean, I don't think I would be, you know, honest if I said, oh, there's no problem with that whatsoever. Like, yeah, ideally, the counties would do everything the same and everyone would have the same, you know, experience when they go to vote. But Judge Brand basically said, like, that's not practicable and it's not feasible in a state like Pennsylvania. Like most states, you know, you have huge counties that are very urban. You have teeny tiny counties that are very rural, and counties have all different kinds of resources and ways of doing things. And, you know, it's like trial judges when they have to sentence someone who's been convicted of a crime. They're given sentencing guidelines. And then within those guidelines, the judges have discretion based on, you know, what they believe and based on the individual defendant. And this is a similar situation. Like, there are guidelines, and certainly if you go outside of those guidelines, there might be constitutional issues. But counties and local authorities have a pretty big, you know, array of discretion within those guidelines to administer elections. They have to, because, you know, somewhere like Philadelphia, which has 1,000 precincts, is very different than somewhere, you know, a county in a rural part of the state that might have a couple thousand voters total. So
yes,
that
totally
makes a
different lot
of sense to me. And I think, you know, we're in the habit these days of saying, oh, you know, we're just blowing things out of proportion. But then when you actually stop and think about it and think about the practicalities of the situation, like, it really does make sense why things have to be a little bit different from here to there.
And I do think that one of the positives you can take from this is that Trump has his entire team, his legal team out there. They're looking for, and I, you know, I do question the judgment on some of his lawyers for the press conferences, but that aside, you know, these guys are sharp lawyers, and I know Jen Ellis is a really sharp lawyer, and so they're looking for fraud. And so the fact that they really can't find any, I would have to assume if it's there, they would have found it. And they would be trumpeting it, and that would be the leading statement of every single press conference. All their affidavits of the fraud, of the magnitude to change the election results, they're not doing it. My takeaway is, then it doesn't exist. And I take comfort in that, right? That our elections do work. Democracy has worked. Again, we are going to have another peaceful change of administration. And the Americans going to prove once again we are the greatest country on the face of the earth. Any thoughts to that?
No, I completely agree. And look, like, I'm sure there are isolated examples of people. Look, there was someone in my township who tried to vote, did vote twice in person on election day, and he was arrested and charged. And that's that. That it happened, apparently, and I'm not here to just drag Republicans, but apparently it was a Republican who had the same name as his son. His son was a junior or something, and his son was a Democrat and didn't vote. So he went in the morning to vote, and he, you know, signed the book as himself, and he told the poll, he said, well, you need to ask for my ID. And the law in Pennsylvania is you only have to show ID when it's your first time voting in, you know, a polling place. And it was not his first time voting. So the poll worker said, I'm not allowed to ask for your ID because it's not your first time voting here. So I cannot ask for it. And he said, well, then everyone's going to commit fraud. And how do you know I am who I say I am? And she said, well, your signature matches. And that's my job. Like, I check the signature and then, you know, you're allowed to vote. So he said, well, I could just vote for my son. And she said, well, no, that would be voter fraud. Please don't do that.
Fraud.
So he voted and he left, and he came back several hours later wearing sunglasses, apparently. I mean, it's like a movie. It really is. So signed the book for his son, and it took a few moments for it to click with the poll worker that this was actually happening. So apparently she stood up and said, don't let him put his ballot in the machine, but it was too late. And the ballot went into the machine. So they had to pull it after, and nobody like even knew what to do because it was so shocking. So they called 911. And the township, we have a wonderful police department in my township. They're phenomenal. But apparently they got like super excited because they were like, oh my gosh, this is the first time this has ever happened. We're so excited. We get to charge voter fraud. So like it does. I mean, then that's kind of like a funny, it's a felony, so I don't know what's going to happen to this guy. It's not funny for him, but it's a very stupid thing that happened. But, you know, when 150 million people vote, like, that's a huge experiment in democracy. And there are going to be inaccuracies. There's the woman in Michigan who typed an extra zero, and it came through as 186,000 votes for Biden, and everyone flipped out, and, you know, it was a typo. Like, those things are going to happen. Fraud is going to happen. Like, it just is. But yes, they're very isolated incidents. They usually, like with the case in Michigan, are remedied very quickly. So things do happen. And I think on the left, on my side of the aisle, we have to just acknowledge that, because if you make a statement like voter fraud doesn't exist, the election was perfect, nothing went wrong, then all the other side, you're setting a very low bar. All the other side has to do is come up with one example of something going wrong, and then they, you know, can just trash your credibility. So certainly these things do happen, but it's nowhere on the scale of a massive RICO conspiracy to steal an election. Like, that just doesn't. It just didn't happen. It just didn't.
Right. Well, we do live in the greatest country. Well, we are basically, I think, almost out of time. Well, the other thing that happened last week that's really noteworthy that we should probably talk about is California v. Texas was argued at the Supreme Court. Did you follow that case at all? That was the case involving Obamacare and whether or not Obamacare is going to be the law of the land next year.
Yes, I actually listened to the oral argument on that case, too, or at least part of
it.
I thought you were going to say Justice Alito's speech at the Federalist Society, but I guess we can talk about that another day because I was shocked.
Well, that's an amazing speech. You're shocked. We will talk about that another day. RBG, you would not have had a problem with RBG's statements to all of her groups, but you don't like Alito talking to the Federalist Society.
I don't have a problem with him talking to the Federalist Society. And I will say, I don't think it was okay when RBG made comments about Trump before the 2016 election, whatever she said. So I don't think that was right. She shouldn't have done that. I don't think she could hold it in. So I'll be fair to both sides. But we can talk about that another day because I was shocked and appalled by it. You thought it was amazing.
Yes.
So it definitely will be an interesting conversation. but yes, I did listen to some of the argument on California v. Texas. It appears to me that Justice Breyer can still not get his technology right.
had
some trouble with the dial-in teleconference. But no, it was a really interesting, argument. And it's an interesting
California
case.
Yeah, California v. Texas. The issue here in this case is Obamacare. And I've been following all these Obamacare cases, and I've almost figured out that I label them as if they're a movie. So Obamacare 1, I don't know if you remember Obamacare 1. This was NFIP v. Sebelius. I call this the case of the Phantom Tax, starring John Roberts. You remember that case?
I love that case.
Oh, that was just a horrible miscarriage of justice. So basically, that the issue in that case was whether or not the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which requires people to get insurance, but health insurance, you got to get it. If you don't, then you got to pay this penalty, or is it a tax? Whatever. We all know you have to do it. And was that a mandate? Can the federal government mandate that you participate in interstate commerce? And that was the issue. And the Supreme Court, in the case of the Phantom Tax, Chief Justice John Roberts was the swing vote there, wrote the majority opinion, and he said, it's not a mandate. No, it's just simply a tax under the tax and spend clause. Now, McKinsey, I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but I think this revolutionized the entire taxing industry. I mean, this totally flipped it of taxation on its head. Now, have you gone to buy a car recently?
No, thankfully. I drive a mom-mobile with 110,000 miles on it, and it's a fantastic car. So I have no plans to buy a car anytime soon.
Well, let's assume you go to buy a car, all right? And let's assume that you tell the salesperson, the first one you go to, you know what? I really can't afford this car. It's not really within my budget. I'm going to have to say no. And the salesperson then looks at you and says, McKenzie, all right, that's fine. I understand not everyone can afford this this car. It is a nice model. All you got to do now is pay the tax for not buying the car, and you could be on your way. Is that really how taxation works? You pay a tax for not buying the item?
Well, that's a sales tax.
I'm telling you, that's not taxation. You don't pay a tax for not buying something. In what, name me one other place in our laws, in our commerce, where that happens.
I'm going to need more time on this one.
I'll give you till next year. You won't come up with it. But nonetheless, in fact, I've even told people there is no other area in any of our economy. I'll give you all the time you want. No one can come up with a single incident or example of where you are forced to engage in commerce. It does not exist. I don't know if you want to play along. Maybe I'll give you till next week to think on this one as well. But this is a revolutionary idea. You cannot force someone mandate that they engage in commerce. Well, what the Supreme Court held in that case was, look, Obamacare is not forcing you to engage in commerce. It's just simply a tax. And so the federal government has the power under the tax and spend clause to do that. All right, that's Obamacare 1. Obamacare 2, Hobby Lobby, finding your corporate religion. Do you remember that case?
I do. But you're going to have to refresh me on it. That was like 3 years ago, right?
Hobby right. Several years ago. Now that we're old, you know, but I can say it happened a couple weeks ago. It happened 3 years ago. But Hobby Lobby, finding your corporate religion, Hobby Lobby had an objection to certain parts of the Affordable Care Act because saying that it required them to provide, you know, birth control, that they violated their religious beliefs and things like that. And so the Supreme Court held that, yeah, okay, that makes sense. You cannot be forced to provide certain birth controls if you have a valid religious objection to it. So that's Hobby Lobby. Then you had Obamacare 3, King v. Burwell, which is, I got to tell you, this is probably my favorite case because Scalia's dissent. I mean, he was on fire. This is open mic night at the local comedy club. He wrote such stuff as, this majority opinion, it's just pure applesauce. And you know what I think of it? This is jiggery pokery. Now, McKenzie, I think that is trash talk at the Supreme Court level to call another person's opinion applesauce and jiggery pokery. I didn't even know jiggery pokery was a word, but nonetheless.
And I love that was applesauce, so there you go.
There you go. And so the mic drop moment was when Scalia said in his dissent that, you know what, the Supreme Court has gone to such great lengths to save Obamacare, maybe we should change it to SCOTUS Care. I think there was a rim shot, you know, somewhere along the lines there, and mic drop moment. But nonetheless, that was Obamacare 3. And now we're on, I think, Obamacare 45, I don't know, California v. Texas. And here's what happened in the interim. Remember that mandate that we were talking about that I had such a problem with? And the tax? Well, in 2017, the federal government passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which took that tax down to $0. And so now the issue is, okay, well, so in other words, if you don't buy this insurance product, you don't have to, your tax is zero. All right. Well, now that there's no tax to save it, is this an unconstitutional mandate? Because we pretty much have established this can be an unconstitutional, this would be unconstitutional to require people to engage in commerce again. In no other area in our economy is that allowed. So what is this? Is this is a tax of zero still valid under the tax and spend clause? Do you have a thought on that issue?
So my thought is, I guess the prevailing wisdom is that, you know, the other issue in the case is severability, right? And whether the whole statute has to fail if the mandate fails. And it looks like that's probably not going to happen. But I think it's a really interesting case to have happen right now, because essentially what you're talking about, the core issue in the case is, can the government, in this case, the federal government, tell individuals they have to do something without backing that up with any kind of penalty, right? Can the government just say, you have to do this? And in this case, it's something, you know, whether it's under the tax and spend clause or whatever, it's the federal government. But we're also experiencing that type of action during the COVID pandemic. I mean, we have local authorities and state authorities issuing all kinds of mandates. And now, unlike the federal government, local authorities and state authorities have very wide, broad police powers with respect to individual citizens. So when
there is a huge difference.
However, you know, in a lot of these cases, like there are some states now where there are orders that say, you cannot have members of another household in your house. You cannot socialize in your home with anyone from another household. Like, that's totally probably unconstitutional and unenforceable. Right. And there's been no threat of enforcement. Like, nobody is saying, to my knowledge at least, we're going to send the police, or you should call the police on your neighbor if you see them having friends over. Like, that's not even discuss. No one is threatening to do that. They're just saying to citizens, like, you have to do this and you can't do this.
Right.
And essentially that's what the Obamacare mandate has been reduced to, because there is no penalty to back it up. Just like, you know, I don't have to pay a tax if I have people outside my household in my household during COVID. So I just think it's really interesting, and it's very on point to what's going on here. And it really, the core issue is so much deeper than just a healthcare law or a pandemic related law. It goes to, you know, what is the role of government? Is government there to be telling people how to live their lives, or is it supposed to be something less than that?
So you've touched on several different great issues there. The one issue is standing. So as you know, when you go into federal court, you have to allege standing, which means you have been injured in some way by this law. That's why you are challenging this law. Now, there is this idea that you don't actually have to be injured as long as the government has shown as long as you have shown a credible threat of enforcement. So the government has said, look, we're going to enforce this law against you. And so you can go ahead and challenge it rather than be arrested first. So there is that idea in the law. So either you have to be injured, or you have to be able to show there's a credible threat of enforcement. But here with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, there's no tax. And so it's $0. Well, there's absolutely no evidence that this is going to be enforced against anyone. This mandate is kind of like a toothless requirement. And so can anyone even challenge it in court? Are we going to relax our standing requirements to allow anyone who is under a law to now challenge it because they don't like the law? And the question was actually asked by Thomas about the mask wearing, as you allege, like this directly applies to what we're going through now with a pandemic. There's a requirement that you have to wear a mask. Well, in a lot of jurisdictions, it's just simply a requirement without any kind of teeth. I mean, last I checked, very few people are turning in their neighbors, and no one's going to jail if they don't wear a mask. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can come up with examples, but that's the issue that was brought up before the Supreme Court. I believe Thomas brought it up. Just because you have a law that you don't like and don't want to follow, but if there's no enforcement of the law, can you challenge it? I don't know. That's a fair question.
Is the court the right place to challenge it? Is the answer, you know, to vote out the bums who are wasting time passing laws that have no teeth? And is the remedy, you know, a democratic remedy, or is there a claim, you know, that someone can bring before that a court could hear and could enact? So it's a very, you know, it's actually a much deeper case than it seems on its surface. And I think it's very timely to what we're going through right now.
Now, you mentioned earlier this idea. It's a huge idea, which is severability. I've been trying to rack my brain on how the court's going to handle this, and I don't know how the court is going to get to its desired result. I do know what the desired result is going to be. The court's going to say Obamacare survives. It is still going to be the law of the land come next June, unless a new Congress changes it for whatever reason, which is a possibility. But outside of that, the Supreme Court is going to keep Obamacare. Now, how it gets there, I have no idea. Are they going to say, look, these challengers here don't have standing to even challenge? We're going to throw this lawsuit out because they don't have standing. I don't know. I think at least the states would have standing here in this case. So I think they're going to get to the merits. So once you get to the merits, is the mandate unconstitutional? I think it is. I think that nowhere else under the law will you be able to find where the federal government, I'm talking about the federal government here, can mandate participation in interstate commerce. All right. So then the issue, it's all going to boil down to severability. Is this provision in this law, this mandate, if it's unconstitutional, can the court just carve that section out and say, look, we're going to take away the mandate? That's the problem. And we're going to leave the rest standing. Can we sever this offensive part out of the law? And so that will be the issue. What do you agree with me that the court's going to let it stand, or how do you think the court's going to handle this case?
I think they are going to let it stand, and I think it's an example of, you know, how the court sometimes can get painted into a corner. I mean, you know, it's interesting. It kind of harkens back to Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings and, you know, all the eloquent kind of soundbites she had about not bringing in her life experiences and her preconceptions into the courtroom. But the fact of the matter is, like, the judges and Supreme Court justices do live in the real world, and they are aware of the real world consequences of their decisions. So, you know, nobody, well, I don't want to say nobody, I'm sure some people do, but nobody really wants to see millions of people get their health insurance taken away. And now with Obamacare, we've kind of created this behemoth system that is just awful in so many ways to so many people,
right.
But it also does, you know, give a lot of people insurance or provide the opportunity to have insurance for millions of people who wouldn't have any insurance otherwise. So it's really kind of a catch-22. Like, it's definitely not the best system. There's a huge problem with healthcare administration in this country. Obamacare is not the best solution. People have differing opinions on what the best solution is or should be, everything from total privatization to Medicare for all to everything in between.
Right, right.
But it's kind of hard. Like, the court would have to just basically say, well, back to the drawing board, everyone. And in the meantime, you know, millions of people lose their insurance in the middle of a global pandemic. Like, it's not going to, like, it's
that's just, not going to happen. No. All right, here's my prediction. I'm feeling somewhat bold now. I think I can be a prophet here when I'm looking to the future. So here's what's going to happen. This is my prediction, and unfortunately, if we go, you know, if we produce this and publish it, it's going to be out there for everyone to make fun of me of later on. But I think Obamacare is going down. Not here, not with this case, but they are going to now take out the mandate. And and so then the issue is, well, then will people stop using Obamacare? I think eventually they will. I think eventually it's so costly that most people are then going to pick another alternative that is a lot cheaper. All right, so that's going to leave Obamacare, which is going to provide health insurance for people who can't afford it or people with pre-existing conditions. And I think that version of Obamacare will be left standing. Will it cost the taxpayer some money? Yes, it will. But after this whole COVID stuff, when we can just print money, who really cares anymore? I think Obamacare is going to stay for pre-existing conditions and also for people who can't otherwise afford insurance. But the vast majority outside of those two contexts are going to go their own route with private insurance. That's just kind of my gut as I'm sitting here right now.
Well, listen, the federal reserve the right budget to change. Is about to get freed up. I mean, with the taxpayer money not having to go to Trump's legal bills anymore, I mean, we should have some wiggle
room.
Or
golf outings.
Yeah, or golf outings. We should have some wiggle room to cover people with pre-existing conditions. So who knows?
That's right. That's my prediction. The one thing I hesitate on saying that is I don't know how Obamacare actually impacts businesses. I mean, obviously, businesses are a huge part. Is there some hook outside of the mandate that Obamacare can force businesses of a certain size? Because if they can do that, it's going to survive. But if they can't, if they don't have that hook for private businesses, it's going to collapse.
Yeah.
That's my prediction.
I can see that. I think you're probably close to on point there.
Yes, but I don't think it's going to go away because I don't think any politician now can get rid of it. It's going to become Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security for people who with pre-existing conditions and cannot get health insurance on the open market, or for people who can't otherwise afford it. It's just going to be basically
free insurance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they'll just, we'll have to assume it in our national economy in some way. Again, at this point, it's all funding money. I don't understand how government just wrote those, you know, stimulus checks this last go around or this, the how much money they put into businesses.
In the memo line, they all said, vote for me, love Don.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't even pretend to understand how that happened, but nonetheless, I guess we'll just see how that all plays out. All right. Thank you so much for joining us today to discuss these important issues, and let's talk next week. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess, Sean Wynn, and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do, Brooke Boland for spreading the good word about us, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.